You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, June 15th, 2011, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Rebecca Watson.
Hello, everyone.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, everybody.
And we have a special guest rogue this week, Michael Waterhouse. Michael, welcome to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you very much, and g'day from Sydney, Australia.
That's right. Michael is in Sydney, Australia. We met him back down in Tam Oz, and he won the auction to have the privilege of coming on the SGU as a guest.
It's a great
privilege.
Sentence, whatever.
It's a great privilege. I've been a fan for a long time. It's a weird kind of thing because I can't work out how long I've been a fan because I've been back and listened to all the old episodes. I feel I've lived your lives with you. It's a bit like the Truman Show. Suddenly I'm entering the set.
That's awesome.
And cue the moon. Go.
Cue the moon. Tell us a little bit about yourself, Michael.
I'm a lawyer. That's my profession. I'm a public servant, and I should just say any views I express here are purely my own and not that of my employer. I work in the state of New South Wales. I've never been a scientist, but I did science at university, and I've always been interested in science, and I've hit upon your podcast as something to exercise by, walk the dog by, and so on, and I really enjoyed Tam Australia when you came out here with others there. I made a lot of new contacts and also just exposed myself to a broader sense of the skeptical movement. I've been now become an aficionado of the Astronomy Cast podcast. I hadn't heard them on your show, I don't think, before that time. I wish I had because I didn't actually get to talk to Pamela Gay, although I knew she was here. And I've started the Quackcast and so on. So I like a few of these.
Yeah, so we were your gateway podcast.
You are. And that's right. It's important to keep on linking up with these other shows, I think.
Yeah, you got to listen to George Rabb's show too. He's got a fantastic.
I do. Yeah, I listen to that from time to time. And
you should also listen to the George Rabb's show.
Yeah, Rabb.
He's a friend of mine. Our good friend's name.
He told me I can pronounce his last name any way that I want. Okay, okay. Rebecca, thank you.
Okay, all right.
So you do listen to George Rubb's show then, right?
Yep.
Rhubarb.
Well, let's get on with our show. Well, Evan, tell us what is special about today.
All right, so we're talking about June 25th in 1994 was the capture of the first live specimen of the Vu Cang ox in Vietnam, which was previously unknown species of mammal, and it was reported in the London newspaper The Times on this date. This is significant. It was the first discovery of a large new mammal species since the okapi in 1910. That's a long time to go between.
I think it's pronounced okapi.
It could be okapi.
Have you ever seen an okapi?
I second that.
This is a pronunciation podcast.
Yes, always.
If we don't pronounce things correctly, we get a flood of angry emails, so it's best to get it right the first time.
Okapi is the funnier sounding one. Okapi. It can't be right.
Now, what happens is we pronounce it five different ways, and one of the five is usually right. So that's how we get away with it.
The okapi is a very rare and reclusive mammal in Africa. Naturalists weren't sure it really existed for a while until one was finally captured. Now you can see them in zoos. You know, I've seen a couple in different zoos.
When we're saying this Vu Cang ox was previously unknown, that presumably means unknown to international science. I mean, were the Vietnamese farming with these oxes for centuries and just never wrote down that they were a different species, or are they out in the jungle somewhere?
Yeah, they're out in the jungle. They're very elusive. They're very quiet, and they're very hard, apparently, to find. And there's not many of them. So all those factors add up to the fact that they've not been captured by scientists and studied, at least alive. The ones they have, there is one in a zoo somewhere in the world. I don't recall where. It could be in Vietnam. And the scientists mostly have gone by working on the carcass of the animals as they find them. Villagers and other natives of those areas, Vietnam and Laos, have captured them before, but they don't survive long in captivity unless you really know what you're doing with these things. They're very delicate in that regard.
Guys, I'm looking at pictures of this. This is that animal that's got those funky flaps between their noses and their eyes. That's such a bizarre thing. What the hell is that?
It's a snout. That flap reveals their snout and their scent glands, and they rub the underside of that against objects, which leaves this kind of paste. And these scent glands are thought to be the largest of any living mammal. So you can imagine the mucus that kind of gets left behind by these.
I'd rather not.
Large glanded creatures.
Ew.
This is also known as the Asian unicorn, by the way. So you may have heard it as that.
Even though it has two horns.
Well,
yeah, what a terrible name.
From one angle, it only has one.
Yeah.
Dual unicorns.
It's taxidermical name. Is that a word, Steve? Taxidermical?
Taxonomical.
It's taxonomical name.
A taxidermical name is
that was good.
Head
that was
on
good.
The wall over there. When you kill good. It and you stuff it, then they call it this.
They only find these things dead anyway, so it's probably taxidermical. Pseudorix inetahensis.
That'd be Unga etahensis, wouldn't it?
I like that its first name starts with pseudo, though.
Pseudorix.
P-S-E-U-D-O. Pseudorix.
Yes. So, but this animal, although it's extremely rare and elusive and known and exists only in a very restricted area, was known from skulls and also horns and then carcasses and eventually was captured, and now you could see one in a zoo. Unlike, for example, Bigfoot. Yeah. Which is known from from no biological material whatsoever.
Just shaky video footage and
stuff that only stuff that can be
footprints.
Faked. Yeah,
give it
rubber
time.
Costumes and other things.
Give it time.
Any day now.
You could.
They're out there.
You could fake a corpse.
Yeah. You'll see.
Just because something hasn't been discovered yet doesn't mean it's undiscoverable.
And in fact, I believe that this ox is actually known as the Asian Bigfoot. Isn't that right?
The point is large mammals. I mean, it's just highly unlikely that a large mammal has totally 100% remains, poop, hair, and all has gone unknown to science all this time, and yet all these sightings.
Yeah.
So think about that when you read your next Bigfoot article.
Okay, let's go on to some news items. First news item is about the fact that we are all mutants, every one of us.
I knew it.
You mean just on the show? Because that's pretty obvious.
Yeah. And all of humanity. We are a subset of humanity, and since all of humanity is mutants, then we are all mutants.
Doesn't that go without saying, though?
I call Wolverine's power. Can heal myself.
No, I want that.
That is the coolest power, absolutely. But anyway,
you better settle down with your enthusiasm too, Bob.
You could argue with that.
I want the mutant power that gives you these sweat glands below your eyes. That's
I think Wolverine had sweat glands. That makes sense, actually. Wolverine was the coolest mutant, but he didn't necessarily have the coolest power. I mean,
immortality is pretty good. Yeah,
super healing, yes, and immortality is sweet.
You could do a lot with that.
Yep.
Although,
give it time.
Although,
excellent.
Stan Lee was asked what his favorite mutant power was, and he gave, I thought, was a very creative answer. He said that he would have the mutant power of luck. If you think about that, that's a pretty damn sweet superpower.
Well, there was a mutant that had that, wasn't there?
Really?
Wait, I think his name is Lucky Pete or something.
Lucky Pete.
Yeah, he had one leg and one eye, but otherwise he was lucky.
My long shot had the power of luck.
Really?
Yeah.
Cool. Well, I mean, are we going to turn this into a segment? Because this is a segment-worthy topic. We really want to
find
it.
I think we've talked about it before.
I think that's enough.
So, my mutant power is an unhealthy obsession with X-Men from the 80s particularly.
I love those unhealthy powers.
Mm-hmm. So there was a study recently published in Nature Genetics looking at the number of mutations that a child has that they inherited from their parents.
60.
Yeah, well, it's a lot.
Spoiler alert.
So they looked at two families with both parents and one child. And then they looked to see how many de novo mutations they inherited from each parent. And they found that on average, though they identified 49 and 35 germline de novo mutations in the two children.
Wait, what kind of mutations?
Yeah, you have to explain
that.
So
in other words, these are new mutations that occurred in the sperm or the egg. Mm.
Okay. You could just say that instead of making up a funny language.
Well, why do you have to say it in Spanish?
I thought it was Spanglish.
Just say new.
Right. De novo is new, and germline means in the sperm or the eggs.
Enough of your techno babble.
And then they found that in one of the children, they received 92% of the mutations from their father, while in the other one, they only received 36% from the father and 64% from the mother, which is a huge variation. Previously, it was thought that most mutations, germline mutations, would come from the father because there was evidence that, you know, there's many more mutations happen in sperm than in the eggs. And that was true for one of the children, but the other one actually got more mutations from the mother. So that this is only, we're only dealing with two data points here, but that still is more variation than when we had thought existed. So that this is, you know, mildly interesting, you know, the new bit of information about how many mutations and where they're coming from. But it is interesting to think how many mutations we're all walking around with. Do you guys know how, on average, out of how many base pairs, for how many base pairs would you have on average one mutation?
Five.
Yeah,
less than one.
Be a puddle of goo. One mutation every five base pairs.
20 million? 20 million?
Close, 30 million. So there's one mutation for every 30 million
Good
base
guess,
pairs
Bob.
That get copied. But of course, we have billions of base pairs. So,
right.
Steve, I have a question for you.
That translates to hundreds of mutations. Yeah.
Are we programmed to mutate?
Well, actually, we have
a
lot.
In a sense, we are.
But there are a lot of mechanisms in place to minimize the number of mutations. And again, it works so well that you only get one error every 30 million, you know, base pairs being copied. But that, because there's billions of base pairs, that still results in a lot of mutations. Fortunately, most mutations, the vast majority, are neutral. Yeah. So there are two main ways in which mutations are neutral. One is that they are literally silent, meaning that you change a G to a T, you know, in the DNA language, but that still codes for the same amino acid. So there's no change in the amino acid. Therefore, the protein is still identical to what it was prior to the mutation. So it's silent. However, there is some recent evidence that suggests that these silent mutations can result in differences in the expression of the gene.
Ew.
So while the protein is the same, the amount of protein that gets made may vary based upon these silent mutations.
That's a deal breaker.
Yeah, so they're not entirely silent, which is interesting. But the other way is when you do swap out one amino acid for another, but they're so chemically similar that it doesn't result in any anatomical change in the protein. Right, the protein basically is the same, even though there's, you know, two different amino acids at one position, as opposed to a mutation which causes a different amino acid that, like, turns a flat portion of a protein into a kink, you know, or something like that, or a really deadly mutation, like one that causes the protein to just stop at that point and then it gets truncated, or a frame shift mutation, right? When you like add in or take away an amino acid, so now the three letter code gets shifted, so they're all now different from that point forward.
Steve, an example of that protein fold is mad cow disease, right?
No. Close, but not quite. So that is a problem of protein folding, but
it's silly cow, not mad cow.
It does not result in a mutation. It is just more – there are more than one ways to fold even an identical protein in terms of its amino acid sequence.
Which those of us who do folding at home know quite well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. So mad cow disease is there's no change in the sequence of amino acids. It's just taken from one folding configuration to another, and the other one, it results in an unstable configuration, you know, in terms of its anatomical functionality, and it causes a breakdown in neurons and and the brain turns to spongy.
It's like folding origami backwards along the same fold or something like that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, it's so complicated. I mean, there's so many different ways that a protein can get folded. It's actually a really tough problem. You know, Rebecca was referring to the protein folding, game, because it's one of those problems that does not yield to just raw computing power. There's too many permutations.
Just to put that plug out there, go to folding.stanford.edu and you can play this game where you can actually help scientists by folding proteins for them. And it's presented to you as a game where you learn different ways to fold these proteins. And then when you get into it, you're actually helping science get done. And
right.
You are learning more about proteins.
So, Steve, these imperfections, these mutations that happen, so it's a drift in our DNA, correct?
Yeah, I wouldn't use the term imperfection, though, because that's kind of a loaded term that implies something that is conceptually, I think, a little bit off. An imperfection implies that what existed previously was perfect in some way. But the fact is that, again, as I said, we are all mutants. Everything is just a variation on the theme, and those variations are evolving, are changing, are creeping along with every generation. There's another 60 or so new changes in the DNA code.
So Jay, next time say less well adapted.
It's not even that. It's most not, changes are lateral.
It's not even that.
The most changes are lateral. They're
either
neutral.
Well, no, but I'm not talking about but I'm not talking about lateral changes. I'm talking ones that are clearly. I think Jay was referring to changes that were clearly cause some dysfunction.
So look at it like this.
Frame shifting, for example.
Let me follow up on what I was going to ask Steve. So, if we average out the amount of changes that take place, the amount of mutations that take place, right? Like I know that if we go down to the individual, it might not be significant, but what changes? So, would someone be born with, say, less capacity for oxygen absorption, and then maybe at the same time they have denser muscle fiber? I'm trying to wrap my head around, what are the aggregate change to a person and then to a group of people and to a society?
Yes, yeah, so, I mean, for every change, I mean, the most reductionist change is that there's a change in the protein itself, which may or may not result in a change in the structure of the protein. If it does, then that will alter the function in some way, which may alter development if it's a developmental protein, or it may change the structure of the tissue or the organ, or it may result in some greater or lesser enzyme activity, for example. So it'll all alter the biochemistry of the body subtly and or sometimes not so subtly. A lot of these mutations are lethal, and those kids are just not born, right? So most spontaneous abortions are because a lethal mutation occurs in the germline. Some are harmful but not lethal, and some may be beneficial. Others may just be different. They're not necessarily harmful or beneficial. It's just a different now assortment of functionality that still works quite well, but it creates the variation, or helps generate the variation that then adaptation evolution can act upon.
So in the X-Men, because these mutants have, for example, some of them have profound powers, to balance that out, shouldn't there be people that are all weird and hunchbacked and mutated in a bad way? I mean, think about it.
Yeah, Jay, we have those.
What is this, a zero-sum game or something?
We have plenty of those, don't we?
I'm just saying it's to balance it out, because if supposedly there's this punctuated equilibrium where mutants, arise and people are immortal and can fly and do all sorts of crazy stuff, there should be stuff on the other end of the spectrum where it's not all positive mutations.
Yeah,
it's negative
all the
mutations.
Dead people that never lived in the first place. That's the other end of the spectrum.
Yeah, a baby's born and it explodes.
That's
how it is. You meant babies dying in funny ways.
Yeah.
Here I was thinking of actual genetic diseases that are horrific. But exploding babies is quite funny.
Do you think twins share the same mutations, or does each person of the each have their own mutation.
So identical twins share all the mutations from the germline,
right?
But there could be mutations that occur even after that. So that you can get what's called a somatic mutation. So as you're developing, for example, a cell may mutate as it's reproducing, and then all the cells that derive from that will have the mutation. You know, for example, some children are born with, say, a patch of white skin. I have this on my leg, actually. I was born with a little patch of white skin on my left leg.
Freak.
And
Achilles.
What that means is at some point when the skin cells were dividing, one of them had a mutation that made it lack pigment, and then all the little patch of cells that derived from that somatic mutation all have that same mutation. So if it happens early enough, it could still be most of your cells or all the cells of a specific organ having mm-hmm. – and that mutation will be unique to you and you wouldn't share it with an identical twin. So yeah, I mean birthmarks are just the most obvious manifestation of that, but that can happen in any tissue.
Now at one point in this article it says a person with a high natural mutation rate might be at greater risk of misdiagnosis. Is that talking about that somatic – as opposed to the germline mutation?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
and can someone have a natural rate of mutation all through their life?
Well, the article was speculating about do different people have different rates of mutation, which I suppose that should vary just like every other biological activity varies. Maybe that's what accounts for the differences in the number of mutations from the mothers and fathers from these two families. Who knows? So if somebody has because of their, machinery, that they have a high mutation rate for whatever reason, they would be at higher risk for cancer. They, might show up false positive on more genetic testing, for example. But I think that's kind of speculative. You know what I mean? Well, let's move on. Bob, you're going to tell us about the human gecko.
Yeah.
I bought insurance from him the other day.
Oh, God. I knew somebody had to bring that up. But it looks like our...
Well, might as well get it over with fast.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for getting that over with quickly. But our buddies at DARPA were in the news again recently. I wasn't aware of this. I don't know if you guys have heard of this. They've got this DARPA Z-Man program that is using biologically inspired climbing aids for the military. First of all, that's kind of like one of their main focus. So what they're doing is they want to allow people or combatants to climb vertical walls made of conventional materials, everyday materials, brick, concrete, wood, or mission specific materials, which of course would depend on the specific mission that they're going on. So I'm not sure exactly what kind of materials they're talking about. But now, of course, when I say that they have them climb, it's without using ropes or ladders. And the ultimate goal is to allow a soldier to climb a vertical surface, while carrying a full combat load. That's kind of like the primary goal that they're shooting for with this. Now they're taking the inspiration from animals like geckos and spiders and small animals. And these animals all share a trait that allows them to climb incredibly well using, generally speaking, reversible adhesion, which is based on one of the following adaptions that you may have heard of. One is an adaptation using the van der Waals forces, which is essentially just the weak electric force that attracts neutral molecules to one another. Now the gecko uses this force to climb almost anything. If you've ever seen the feet of a gecko, they've got it's incredibly complicated structures. They've actually got millions of setae, I think it's pronounced setae, which are these microscopic hairs on the bottom of their feet. And if you could look at each one of these tiny little hairs, what you'll see is that each one ends with like 1,000 or more even tinier structures at the tips called spatulae. And these are only about 200 billionths of a meter wide, which is actually below the wavelength of visible light. So these are incredibly tiny, and they can actually kind of snuggle themselves around extremely small areas at the molecular scale.
So it's like Velcro.
It's kind of like Velcro, but they're using this this very subtle electric force. And when you've got millions and millions and billions of these hairs, it all adds up to create a sticking force that allows them to pretty much walk on almost anything.
I know, Bob, do those hairs, are they able to poke through fabric? For instance, if you were a superhero wearing a skin-tight outfit and you wanted to climb walls, say, like a man spider sort of thing.
I think they'd be tiny enough to go through pretty much most weaves, absolutely, if they're that tiny. So the other adaptation, besides this using the van der Waals forces that the gecko does, is what's called hook-into-surface asperities. this idea is that animals like insects and spiders use this technique. And it's basically these tiny, tiny hairs that don't use the electric force, but they actually can just hold on. They get purchased on these little tiny irregularities that exist on almost any surface. So if you've got enough of these structures on your legs, you can pretty much climb on most walls by just grabbing all these little tiny asperities or irregularities that are kind of poking their way out of the wall.
So that is like Velcro.
That is kind of, yeah. That's much more like Velcro, definitely. That's closer to Velcro than what the gecko does. So using these two techniques, they've come up with they've actually created these human-sized analogs that they've created, and I couldn't find any videos of this. I'm not sure.
Yeah. Why isn't there, if they've done it, why aren't there any videos? I mean, we demand evidence for some things. Why aren't we demanding it for this?
I agree.
I understand you.
Because it's a state secret or something? It's all classified.
Probably patent.
Are you telling me? They got to put a guy in a costume and have that freak climb up the wall. Come on. Right?
No, I think we'll see that soon enough, though, if this really works. And
if they do that and they put that video up and they say it cost $100 to see the video, I would pay the $100.
Oh my god!
You would do that, really?
I would.
Yeah, let me know how it turns out.
Well, I didn't do an exhaustive search of YouTube, so somebody might find it and let us know if you find something about this. So what they've actually done, what they can accomplish right now using these
allegedly
techniques, yeah, yeah, I guess whatever. I'm pretty confident. They've used a fully
good enough
a 300-pound soldier, which, I mean, he doesn't weigh 300 pounds, but with all the equipment, so it's a fully loaded soldier climbing a vertical wall made of what they call the mission relevant materials. This person was able to climb using these techniques, and they also had a 150-pound soldier that obviously didn't have any extra gear. He was able to climb vertical walls made up of multiple different types of building materials.
Are they tested it with Osama bin Laden's compound, the materials on those walls?
Actually, these suits, I'm not sure how to describe them. They're actually working on getting them to soldiers today. For all I know, they might already have them. The demonstration that I read about, they did so well. The people were just so psyched when they saw this because it was so far above the current state of the art. They really blew them out of the water. And one of the reasons why they did that was that one of the recent innovations they made was that they were able to use magnetic switching somehow. And this was another frustratingly vague part of this research that I was doing. They didn't really go into much detail about this magnetic switching, but apparently it uses negligible external energy, which is very good for soldiers. The energy is at a premium. So what I think they're doing with their magnetic switching is they're able to reverse the adhesion, which is important because, you know, you want it to stick sometimes. And obviously as you're moving, you want to unstick yourself. And they can't do it like geckos. Geckos are very bizarre because they actually can fold up their feet backwards. They like curl their toes up backwards to kind of like disengage from the surface. And that's it's a really bizarre looking thing, which obviously people can't do. So I think they're using this magnetic switching to actually do that. You know, once it gets into the army, who knows? Maybe we might see regular people with this stuff in a few years. It would be really cool. I really want to see what this stuff looks like and what it could really do.
Yeah, that's pretty cool.
But can you imagine when anybody can, slap on these gloves and start climbing up buildings and stuff?
Imagine the crimes that can be committed using this stuff.
Whatever. My third floor apartment in Boston got broken into, and
Superman will stop.
They probably didn't need that to break in.
How do you know? How do you know they didn't
all
use
they needed
it?
Was because if they did, then they crowbarred my door to pieces afterwards for no apparent reason.
That'll throw you off.
But I don't, I think I would be very scared to, climb up the outside of a building if I also didn't have Spider-Man's webby thing, because like, what if you fall backwards? Like, what if the Hobgoblin jumps on you and you fall back and you got to have something to latch you.
Yeah, some sort of anti-Hobgoblin device would be handy.
You mean the Green Goblin, right?
Could wear like the personal
they
jetpack.
They both exist. Yeah,
there you go. As well, just as a safety measure.
Parachute.
Just saying.
200-pound safety measure.
Yeah. All right, but no idea when we're going to see this in our SkyMall catalog.
Yes, 2017.
17, okay.
I have no idea.
Ooh, solar eclipse here.
I can wait till then.
All right. Rebecca, tell us about the creationists' latest attempts to sneak into mainstream geology and science.
Yeah, I think I've talked before about I have some friends who are biologists at Harvard who have told me about actual creationists that have been in their classes and their in their labs. I had a friend who got his who's doing his graduate degree alongside a real serious creationist. And what happened when they graduated was they went to work for the Discovery Institute, who had been covering their education, you know, giving them scholarships, and then they would go around and do lectures at churches as, you know, a PhD, an actual doctor, for instance, who believes in creationism. And that's the way they would use their particular, their degree. Well, it turns out that there's an even worse thing happening amongst geologists. Recently, Stephen Newton of the NCSE, which we're all very familiar with because of their work fighting creationists, you know, for instance, in Texas, when they're trying to get creationist language sneaked into textbooks. Well, Stephen wrote a really great article about how at a geologist conference, the annual meeting of the Geological Society of America, last year they went on a field trip, and the field trip was actually hosted by and given by creationists. Steve Austin is a fairly well-known creationist.
Bionic Man, too.
And also the Bionic Man, and also, I think, a professional wrestler. I could be wrong.
Oh, yeah. Stone Cold Steve Austin.
Yeah.
Gets around.
6,000 years old.
So the good Stephen, Stephen Newton, discusses how the creationists have basically been infiltrating these serious scientific conferences. You know, I mean, this isn't just any conference. This is the Geological Society of America. They're infiltrating these, and they're giving talks, and they're leading field trips, and they're doing it so that they can sneakily insert bits of creationism into serious scientific discussion.
And the people who run these things have no clue?
The thing is, they don't say anything that's out and out contradictory to the scientific evidence. They basically skirt the rules in much the same way that we've seen the creationists use the wedge theory to get their sort of religious-based quote-unquote science worked into education. You know, we've seen them basically be very, very vague about things or, you know, not directly say God made the earth and evolution is a lie. Rather, they're saying, you know, evolution has its faults and we are presenting an alternate viewpoint. Well, in much the same way, they're doing that at these geological conferences. So they're, the field trip that Newton describes is mostly on the up and up, except for when they suddenly mention that certain geological features could only be explained by a great flood, for instance. And they do it using real scientific terminology. They couch it in actual science that no one disputes, and they slip it in and then they move on. And that's been their, so far, apparently very successful tactic, because the people who are hosting these conferences aren't kicking them out. You know, they're not even advertising the fact that these people are creationists. So it's been up to a few particular geologists who understand what's going on to call these people out on what they're doing.
But also, Rebecca, the other reason that they're doing this, it's not just because they're slipping in this very coy, deceptive, vague references to to young Earth, you know, creationism, or like the Noah's flood, without ever mentioning the Noah's flood, etc. But then after the meeting, they immediately will use this, the fact that they gave a lecture, that they sponsored a tour at the GSA, as a way of saying that, hey, look, our young Earth creationist views are being accepted into mainstream science, into the GSA. It's all legitimate.
Right.
You're using it to generate a false sense of legitimacy for their views.
And that's, yeah, that's what I was going to get to next, is to bring it back around to exactly what my biologist friends have been telling me coming out of Harvard. These biologists have been using this sort of, well, you know, my degree is from Harvard, and, you know, they place a lot of emphasis on using the sort of trappings of upper echelon science as a way to get legitimacy. So, you know, I feel that a lot of them have this sort of disdain for science, and yet at the same time, they will gladly use it to further their own purposes. So yeah, in much the same way that they tout Harvard educated PhDs on their side, they are also using the fact that they're speaking at these scientific conferences as some sort of evidence that their views are being taken seriously, when in fact that's not true at all. They're simply being overlooked because people aren't being vigilant enough.
I wonder whether they actually have a kind of dual view in their mind, these creationists. I mean, there's a quote there saying that, well, I use a scientific framework for a scientific audience, and I use a creationist framework for a creationist audience. It sounds like they have some kind of philosophy or worldview that sort of says truth is totally relative depending on the circumstances in which I'm in.
I think the simpler interpretation is that they're lying.
Yeah, they're sneaky. They're sneaky when they need to be sneaky. For me, the big question, my knee-jerk reaction to this is they should be banned. They shouldn't even be there. You know, why? You know, what are they even doing there? But the author made some pretty good points that, you know, by not allowing them to participate in the meetings, they can pull the whole martyr trick and give the misperception that we are pretty much hostile to any view. So it's dangerous. It's dangerous to do that. But so in a sense, I kind of agreed with his point to a certain extent that, yeah, they are following the rules. If superficially, they are following the rules required to lead these trips and to display their posters and talk. They are doing that, but we just need, it's good for the scientists, for real scientists, to be aware so that they can challenge them and throw things at them that they can't just explain away.
Right. I agree, Bob. I think that if you're going to let them attend these conferences, it needs to be completely above board. You need to know who is sponsoring them and honestly what their intent is. But right. That said, I don't necessarily support the idea of allowing them into these conferences because we fear that they'll play the martyr card, because what they've taught us again and again is that they're going to play the martyr card no matter what we do. And, you know, they certainly play it every time we kick creationism out of the classroom. We get this expelled, you know, sort of language. They're unable to handle our truths, you know. We're being censored. We hear that every time. And at some point, I think we have to be, you know, as people who are focused on science and on, you know, on real science, on the actual scientific process, I think we need to stand up and defend it and say, no, this isn't censorship. This is science, and there's no science in what you're doing.
But doesn't the science come out by saying, all right, if they publish something, they try to get something submitted to a journal, it's peer reviewed, it doesn't get published if it doesn't pass examination by others, it gets criticized, and science sorts it out in the long run.
Yeah, but the article mentioned that, like, for the tour groups, there's actually no rule that says anything about the content of the tour. So in my opinion, that's a problem with the rules. You know, how about in putting in the rules that
sure,
the
that
content
should be
has to be reviewed and be acceptable consensus or mainstream scientific content? I would even put, you know, you could even craft some kind of language that says that, you know, we reserve the right to reject any whatever tour or paper or lecture or proposal that we deem is subverting the cause of science in order to promote an ideological agenda.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, I would agree with that. And Steve, another aspect of the article that kind of is related to that caught my attention. It said that the GSA Sedimentary Geology Division had initially signed on as a sponsor for the trip, but then they backed out once they learned that the views of the trip leaders. Now, of course, I was thinking, all right, how did they find out, and why, and if they found out, and maybe it was totally serendipitous that they even found out, and they could have backed them without even, you know, without even knowing about the true nature of these guys. I mean, how did they find out? And it should be more clear to anyone who could potentially sponsor one of these things. Hey, here are the trip leaders now, and here's what you need to know about them before you even think about sponsoring this trip.
In a way, this reminds me of the way that we needed James Randi to go into labs studying homeopathy, because the scientists who were looking at the actual studies, at the research, weren't able to detect out and out fraud. You know, they were expecting honest science to be done, and that was not actually what's being done. You need a magician to detect deception. So in the same way, I think that these creationists are being extremely dishonest, and as you know, as a scientist who might be attending a scientific conference or even hosting a scientific conference, you may, if you're not a skeptic, you may go in with the assumption that all of the people you're going to be dealing with are going to be above board scientists who use the same processes as you do, who are as concerned as you are about eliminating their own biases, things like that. You don't expect people to come in with that kind of intent. And so I think it's great that groups like NCSE exist, because they are so good at sniffing that sort of stuff out.
See, that's Jeannie's mutant power. She has that ability.
Yes, the ability to sense bullshit.
Michael, how much of a problem is creationism in Australia?
Well, I think there's less of a problem than there might have been, say, 10, 20 years ago, when certain conservative governments in Queensland, for example, had an agenda for that. I know that at the TAM Australia conference, the new national curriculum body was awarded the Ben Spoon Award for apparently allowing creationism to be taught in Australian schools. My own personal view is I don't think that's what that authority has done. It still has clear mention of evolution, and it's very much a framework document. And I think it's very clear in Australia there's a much greater general belief in evolution, even among those people who are Christian or religious, than it appears there is from surveys in America asking similar questions. So I would say 75% of people in surveys say that they believe in evolution, either God-assisted or God-led or without a creator leading it, but they believe in the theory of evolution. So I think it's much more of a minority view in Australia. There's certainly people around who are wanting to promote it, and I think it is by and large kept to particular Christian schools in terms of education. That's my perception.
And you know, Australia, like the United States, and unlike the UK, you guys have an actual constitution, right?
We do. We have a written constitution. We've had for about a bit over 100 years.
And there is a separation of church and state clause in there?
Well, there's an anti-establishment clause. It's not really a separation of church and state, but it's very similar in its wording to the First Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, but it hasn't been interpreted in the same way by our equivalent of the Supreme Court, the High Court. The High Court back in 1981, you might or might not be aware that governments, both state and federal, fund non-government schools, which are primarily church-based schools. They can also be Muslim schools, for example. Most of them are religious schools, and they get a significant amount of funding from both tiers of government to support kids going to those schools. And there was a challenge against that in the High Court back in 1981, which was withdrawn. And the High Court said, our law against the establishment of a religion is about not saying that there won't be any association between church and state, but just that there won't be any official religion, or there won't be any favoritism between particular religions. So between, let's say, Catholicism and Anglicanism. And that stems, I think, in the court's interpretation, to the idea that back in 1900, our main religious problem was sectarianism between particular sects of religion, between Catholics and non-Catholics, or Catholics and Protestants. And it was assumed, it wasn't assumed that it was freedom from religion. But interestingly, there has been a set of new developments. The Commonwealth government over the last few years has been funding chaplains in schools, both government and non-government schools. So these are people who can teach religious education in schools for a certain amount of allocated time. They can be there as providing what they call pastoral care, which I think I'm not exactly sure what makes it pastoral if it's not some kind of religious content. And there's a current High Court challenge, which is coming up in August.
Yeah, I mean, definitely over the last couple hundred years, the Supreme Court has interpreted the First Amendment to mean that the government can't do anything to promote religion. They're, you know, very specifically, like, they, for example, they cannot teach religion in the public schools. Over the years, there are some decisions that have come down that seem to be contradictory, or they do split hairs very finely. It does depend on the composition of the court at the time. Like, for example, I think it was in the 1990s when these two atheist kids who were kicked out of the Boy Scouts, and they sued, and it went all the way to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided that the Boy Scouts, as a private organization, have the right to do that, although the Boy Scouts are funded by the federal government, which didn't seem to come into play. So that seems, you know, contradictory, in my opinion, to some other decisions that the Supreme Court has made.
Well, in all of the states in Australia, government schools, public schools, must allow, I think it's an hour a week, for religious education for those parents of children who nominate to do so. So every parent has the right to nominate their child to have religious education or to be free from religious education. And just recently in New South Wales, there's been a new option for those who are not taking religious education, which is to do secular ethics, which is an interesting development. But
yeah,
there's still, in one sense, a freedom of religion. No one is forced to attend a particular religious instruction and so on, but it's a much different legal framework than in the United States, and certainly it wouldn't be something that we could mount a case like the Dover, I think it's the Dover trial, that's the one that was recent, the Kitzmiller. Yeah, that we wouldn't be able to use that same kind of argument under our constitution, even though the words in the constitution are very similar. It's really splitting hairs on the meanings of the words. So it will be interesting to see whether the High Court is influenced by more recent judgments in the United States, because there does seem to be a greater international focus on how have other superior courts decided these things. So it'll be a very interesting case to watch when it comes up in a month or so.
Evan, tell us about Battery Man.
Battery Man. Not just Battery Man.
Battery Man hates Galaxy Man.
Oh, it's even better than that. I know you had to get that in, but it's even better than that because Battery Man has stunned scientists.
Stunned.
Mm. Awesome.
He's left scientists scratching their heads, according to our friends at the Daily Mail out of the United Kingdom. Shame on them.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
That's all you really needed to say.
Battery Man has stunned scientists by conducting 20,000 volt current through his body without feeling a thing. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
All right. So what we have reportedly is a gentleman by the name of Slavisa Podkick.
Podkick.
Well, I think the J is silent. I think it's Podkick.
Podkick.
Footsteps.
Don't worry. The listeners will let us know.
They definitely will. And he's from Serbia. He can withstand high voltages without feeling a thing, apparently. He claims that he can act as an insulator, a conductor, and even a heater. Where have we heard this before? I'm pretty sure we've heard or seen people who claim to be able to do these sorts of electricity conducting bits.
Yeah. He must be a mutant.
Yeah, that's his mutant power.
It actually probably is. when you read into
He's Electro.
He apparently has, oh, not apparently, he does. He has an entry in the Guinness Book of World Records back in
Actually, I would revert to apparently because I don't think that's been verified.
Well, they actually showed in the video, we can't show you on this podcast, of course, flipping through the book of that year, and there is a picture that looks like him. Now, there wasn't enough time for me to try to figure out what all the words on that page were, so... And he seemed like he was doing something with his hands in regards to electricity. So he's in there. But with just a little bit of research, 5 minutes worth or so on the beloved internet, you need not go any further than skeptic.com, skepdic.com. And our good friend Bob Carroll there said he cannot find any evidence that his claims are true that he holds a record for taking a hit of 20,000 volts. Now, he may be in there for some other ability, but certainly not for that. He says there's nothing about testing a man by shooting 20,000 volts into his body in that book.
Yeah.
But one has to wonder whether this person is really conducting electricity at all.
Well, I'm sure he is. Small amount, right?
Not 20,000 volts.
Like a potato. Potatoes conduct electricity.
So what's the trick here, guys? What's he doing?
He says according to his claims and video footage of him, he takes these electrical tongs, right, or these forks, actually. He holds the forks, right, which have these wires and alligator clips and attachments to them that go off to these, well, you know, meters or electrical devices and so forth. And through his powers, he can cook a sausage, which are stuck to that fork. He can also...
That's a handy talent.
Now, according to a letter written by a local from Serbia who saw this guy in person... He and you could see from the videos, he is a mutant in that he is hairless. He doesn't have any hair, eyebrows, eyelashes, nothing.
Alopecia.
Yeah, but totalis. He has no hair on his body.
Like Matt Lucas.
And apparently he also has no sweat glands.
Ooh.
Which is very debilitating. You can't go out in any kind of... warmth to do any kind of exercise, or you have to have some kind of external cooling mechanism. It is very debilitating not to have decreased or no sweating. But what the guy said was that he has very, very unusual looking skin that appears to be very, very thick. So perhaps the only thing that is different about this guy is that his skin is unusually thick and it's very, has a very high resistance, which means that he can tolerate more, exposure to more electricity because it's just not going to conduct through his thick skin. It's kind of like wearing rubber gloves, and then you can handle a lot more. So his skin is just more insulating. But that may be it. That may be why he can hold the forks. But he's not. There's no evidence, and his videos do not demonstrate this, that he is generating electricity from himself. The demonstrations he gives, there are wires, going to the things that are conducting the electricity, right? I mean, it's just that he can hold on to it is the only thing that's maybe a little unusual. So that's his mutant power, thick skin.
That is.
Right, so you think he does have a real physiological difference. It's not some trick.
Well, it's interesting if he really lacks sweat glands, if that report is true, which exists, and it's not that unusual. There are people who are known to exist with that. That would mean his skin would be dry and thick, and it wouldn't be moist, and there wouldn't be any sweat on the surface of his skin to conduct.
I don't know, Steve. There are other cases though of people reportedly having similar or the same ability to do this, and from what I've read, there are a couple of other famous cases, and one actually I saw on television, a fellow by the name of Jose Rafael Marquez Alaya from Puerto Rico, and I saw this on a Discovery Channel show, and he did a lot of the same things that the Serbian fellow did. There was no reference to any biological condition that he was that made him special.
A lot of these tricks are tricks that anyone can do, lighting the light bulb and all that kind of stuff.
And to wrap this up, he wants to try to set a new world record by what he says, charging on a 1,000,000-volt power generator and shooting lasers from his fingers.
Yeah, good luck with that.
Look forward to seeing that.
Why doesn't he shoot photon torpedoes, too, out of his butt?
Right. Well, guys, we did last week. We talked about, you know, biological lasers. So you never know. This guy could be a mutant that has that thing going on.
Yeah, well, you know, as skeptics, no. We keep an open mind.
We do.
You know, if we're shown the evidence, we'll gladly accept it.
Right. Under controlled conditions, let's see lasers shoot out of his fingers. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, control. That's
it's an extraordinary claim. Yeah. Does require extraordinary evidence.
It does.
That's true. Evan, tell us about Who's That Noisy?
I will. Here we go. All right.
What animal was that, Evan?
Well, if you remember, I also gave a hint on the last show.
Oh, yeah.
That if you had to break this down into three classifications, animal, mineral, or vegetable, that was not the noise from an animal.
It was a carrot.
Animal.
It was the screaming carrot of Fu Manchu.
Any other guesses? Well, that was a watermelon.
A watermelon? Yeah. I was close. So
very
close.
What? Come on.
That is a watermelon.
Explain yourself, young Jedi.
Watermelons, along with other fruits, go through a process called natural fermentation, which the juices that are all activated by the microorganisms that are causing the fermentation need a place to go as it bubbles up. So what happens is it breaks through the skin or the surface of the watermelon, causing little tiny holes where you can start kind of actually see the juices start to bubble out, and the pressure causes that noise to be made.
So it's a drunk watermelon.
Yes, actually. Now, on the day I chose this noisy from the last show, because on the same day that someone sent in that clip of the watermelon for us to use, I had a pineapple on my counter at home that same day. And I went over to it. What are the odds? And I went into the kitchen that day, and I'm like, who spilled a beer in here? What is going on? The kitchen reeked of beer. So I'm looking around. All of a sudden, I see all this kind of foam on the counter dripping down the side and spilling onto the floor. What is going on here? My pineapple burst open.
And you said, who put pineapple juice in my pineapple juice?
What are
good.
So the pineapple went through the same process, and it stunk. And for me, it literally smelled like beer.
But it didn't scream.
No, I didn't hear it. No, I didn't go there, because I read some online testimonials about people who have eaten.
Your scientific rigor is found lacking.
That have gone through this, and they've almost vomited from the experience.
Did you ever have whole wheat bread ferment in your bread draw?
Every day.
I had a crumpet ferment recently.
Did you?
I did. It smelled like beer.
I made myself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich today. And then when I went to eat it, the bread was like smelled like it had fermented, and I couldn't eat it.
Steve, that was a great story, but what I really liked was how excited Bob was at the fact that he had also had a peanut butter and jelly sandwich.
That was my dinner, a triple-decker peanut butter and jelly.
But I didn't get to eat it. Yummy.
Well, in Australian prisons, they use Vegemite for their surreptitious sly grog.
Well, they're prisoners.
You must have tried Vegemite while you were here.
Vegemite grog. You know, yeah. I did, too,
and it was vile.
It was vile.
Sorry.
What? You guys are nuts.
It must be an acquired taste.
Vegemite. I don't want to acquire it, though.
Yeah. Evan, what do you got for this week?
All right. I first must ask, is everyone ready for this week's Who's That Noisy?
No.
Wait.
Right. Well, let me know when you're ready.
Ready as I'll ever be.
Yes.
Do it.
I know Michael's got things to do. I'm sorry for keeping you. Here we go. Who's That Noisy?
I did a physics degree at Imperial College, and I did 4 years postgraduate in the motions of zodiacal dust in the solar system. And then something called me, and I had to go.
Okay, there you have it.
Mm-hmm.
I think someone's going to get it, but be the first one to get it. info@theskepticsguide.org is our email, or join our forums and post your answer there. Good luck, everybody.
Thanks, Evan. Let's go on to science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fictitious, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is fictitious. Michael, are you ready for this week?
I hope so.
Okay, here we go. Item number one, a review of research finds that the transition to agriculture from hunter-gathering consistently led to a decrease in height and overall health. Item number two, a recent study finds that college students who have later class start times have less daytime sleepiness and better grades. Item number three, researchers have developed a treatment for diseases that result from genetic mutations which cause protein synthesis to stop prematurely. All right, Michael, as our guest, you get to go first.
Thank you. It's always the worst position. And anyway, I normally find hints from others, but hopefully my hints may help others. A review of research finds that the transition to agriculture from hunter-gathering consistently led to a decrease in height and overall health. That doesn't sound plausible to me. As I understand the way things develop, we've consistently seen an increase in height. Why would it? I can't immediately think of a plausible reason for that. Move on to the next one. A recent study finds that college students who have later class start times have less daytime sleepiness and better grades. Well, that makes sense to me. Sleep in, more concentration, don't get up too early, consolidate memory better if you have better sleep, assuming later sleep means better sleep if they've gone to bed late, longer sleep. That does seem to make some sense to me. And researchers have developed a treatment for diseases that result from the genetic mutations which cause protein synthesis to stop prematurely. It sounds like if there was some intervention that if they could find the reason that the genetic mutation caused the protein to stop and plugged it in with a gap which would keep the normal process of synthesis going. I mean, yes, it sounds like a good advance, but it does sound to me plausible. So I think I'll go with my gut instinct and say that the first one is the fake.
The one about agriculture.
The one about agriculture is the fake.
Okay.
I think it's the opposite direction.
Okay, great. Jay?
All right, so the first one that says research finds that transition to agriculture from hunter-gathering consistently led to decrease of height and overall health. That doesn't seem to make much sense to me. That they would be actually that they would decrease in height and health because they became an agricultural culture. That's weird. I mean, does it mean that maybe they ate less meat? I don't know. A recent study finds that college students who have later class start times have less daytime sleepiness and better grades. I totally agree with that. Of course, right? Like, why make people get up early? Kids need more sleep anyway. And the final one, researchers have developed a treatment for diseases that result from genetic mutations which cause protein synthesis to stop prematurely. Why? Sure. Absolutely on that one. I think the first one about agriculture is the fake.
Okay, Rebecca?
One of these jumped out at me immediately as being not correct. And unfortunately, once again, I go against my fellow panelists. To me, it's the idea that college students who have later class start times have less daytime sleepiness and better grades. That doesn't sound quite right to me because, you know, the implication is that sleeping later in the day somehow benefits students, but sleeping later doesn't make you any more able to take tests and whatnot. Getting a good night's sleep might, but, just from my experience in college, people with later start times to their classes were more likely to stay up late partying the night prior, and so they wouldn't necessarily get a good night's sleep. So I'm going to go ahead and say that that one is in fact the fiction.
Okay, Bob?
Yeah, I thought of that as well, Rebecca. I mean, just because you've got a later class does not necessarily mean that you're going to be going to bed the previous night at the same time as if you had an early class. So yeah, that's the obvious way out of that one. For the third one, that sounds impressive that they're able to deal with this genetic mutation that causes protein synthesis to stop. It's fairly impressive, although we are making some big strides with genetics in that specific area. It's still a little bit surprising. Yeah, but possible. The first one, I don't know why this one does seem kind of weird to me. The transition to agriculture from hunter-gatherer, I could see an effect on height. Who knows how the different macronutrients and how the vitamins shifted as you go from hunter-gatherer to agriculture. I could see how that shift could potentially lead to a lack of some things and not others, and perhaps affecting height. But overall health, I still think that the overall health was probably pretty good. I don't know. There's something about that one. I'm going to have to say that one's fiction.
Okay, Evan?
Everyone kind of touched on everything already. I'll say that for the one regarding later class start times, only because I recently got through a semester of having evening classes, I'll use my own anecdote, therefore, and I did do very well in those classes. I was leading up to those evening classes, I'd be reviewing my books, my notes, and so forth. So I was probably better prepared as opposed to, kind of waking up in the morning and having to scramble to a class with my head half in the fog and not concentrating as much as I might have if I didn't have the afternoon to review some stuff. So I'm going to go with the agriculture one with the other guys and say that one is fiction.
Oh, man.
Oh, boy, Rebecca, you're all by your lonesome again. This week. All right, well, let's start with number three, since you all agree that researchers have developed a treatment for diseases that result from genetic mutations which cause protein synthesis to stop prematurely. You all think that one is science, and that one is science.
Nice try.
Yeah. There we go.
Still pretty cool.
Yeah, very cool.
How are they dealing with the mutation itself?
Yeah, so
what vector are they using?
So this is, I actually referred to this a little bit earlier in the show. This is a stop codon mutation where the mutation changes the three nucleotide code from coding for an amino acid to basically saying stop synthesis here, right? So that truncates the protein right at that point. So you got a little protein fragment rather than the full protein, and the protein fragment doesn't work. So it doesn't do its job, and that's bad. About a third of genetic diseases is this kind of mutation, according to this article. And what they found is a way to get the protein synthesis mechanism to ignore that stop codon in the middle of the protein and to go on to complete the rest of the protein. That what they did was they were able to alter messenger RNA, and we're able to actually match it to the section of the RNA with the mutation, so it only affects the mutation and not the normal stop codons in the production of proteins.
Sweet.
Yeah. So they tested it both in the petri dish and in animals. So it seems to work in vitro and in vivo.
Cool.
That's cool. Yeah, so obviously needs a lot of work before it'll ever get to people, but anything that could reverse the effects of a horrible genetic mutation like that has tremendous potential.
All right, moving right along.
Let's see.
The main event.
I guess I'll just go back to number one. A review of research finds that the transition to agriculture from hunter-gathering consistently led to a decrease in height overall. And overall health, the guys think that this one is the fiction. Rebecca is by herself and thinking that this one is science. Mm-hmm. And this one is science.
Wow. Nice, Rebecca.
Good job,
nice.
Rebecca. Two weeks in
again.
A row.
All right, what the hell?
And this is counterintuitive, right? Because you think that, agriculture meant a steady supply of food, so why aren't they better? But you got to remember, this was transitioning to agriculture 10,000 years ago. They looked at research looking at like every different culture, in Asia, Europe, Africa, wherever. And every time that this transition occurred, the health actually decreased as well as height.
But it still led to overall survival or overall improvement, presumably for the agriculture to continue.
Yeah, well, the societies survived, and it was, you were able to support a larger population because they had more food. But there's a few things that you need to keep in mind that, you know, just transitioning to agriculture. So they hadn't quite sorted the whole agricultural society thing out yet, right? So for one thing is they immediately started relying upon a much narrower range of food. Rather than gathering a whole bunch of different kinds of food, now they're eating corn. Or wheat, or rice, or whatever. Now, over time, societies developed more of a range of agricultural products. And it was actually on a previous show, I think it was one with Kenny Fader, who pointed out that every culture that relies heavily on one type of, you know, grain as their primary food source has a secondary one that is nutritionally complementary, that fills all the gaps left by the first one. But that takes time, you know, to develop your repertoire of crops that will give you a good range of nutritional sources. And also, a lot of cultivation hadn't occurred yet, right? So these were much more primitive versions of crops that we're eating today. So they didn't, and cultivation has actually, even prior to, you know, genetic engineering or modification or anything, just good old cultivation actually has made more nutritious crops over the last 10,000 years.
And Steve, they probably didn't even know that there was a nutritional gap, right?
No, they didn't know from nutrition 10,000 years ago. All they knew, oh, lots of food. Great. We'll eat this now. You know, I also thought of the probably they were getting less protein thing, but that wasn't mentioned in the articles I was reading, but that seems to make sense if they're shifting, you know, more of their diet to grains and doing less hunting. Maybe they were getting less protein.
You need so little protein though to get along, don't you?
But the thing is, height is a good measure of, you know, overall nutrition, yeah, as a child, and until the 20th century, you know, where height sort of took off, most societies were nutritionally limited to the point where, you know, people were a lot shorter, you know, than we are today.
I'm not sure. I'm nutritionally challenged.
My favorite example of this, by the way, is the carrot.
Oh, yeah.
You guys know the story of the carrot? There are actually many different colors of carrot. White.
Yellow.
And yellow and like black. Purple. But the orange carrot actually was a very late cultivar. I think it we're not exactly sure when it emerged, but it was sometime in the Middle Ages. By 1700, it was definitely around. But so sometime before then, it emerged, and it was a mutation in a cultivar of carrot that created beta carotene, which is a very important vitamin, precursor to vitamin A. And the orange carrot became a food staple because it had this nutritional aspect to it, but all the previous non-orange carrots didn't have that, and they weren't really very useful nutritionally. Isn't that interesting?
And where do carrots come from?
Very.
Well, they're
keratosis.
They're related to what we call Queen Anne's lace in this country.
Yep, you can find it. It's a plant that has the white flat flower that looks like a piece of lace.
Yeah.
And if you pull it out by the root and you break the root in half, it smells very much like a carrot.
Yeah. So all of this means that a recent study finds that college students who have later class start times have less daytime sleepiness and better grades is the fiction. And Rebecca, you totally nailed it, that this study showed that students who had later class times stayed up late and drank more alcohol. And the drinking is related to poorer sleep and poorer cognitive function. Now, keep in mind, again, this is the fiction, so it could be a crappy study, right? Because it's different. If I'm saying something's true, it has to meet certain criteria for being a reasonable study. But I think this is just a correlational study. This wasn't an intervention study. So they didn't like randomize students to sleeping later, you know, taking later classes or taking earlier classes. They simply just asked students when their first class was and, you know, how they got their grades, and they, you know, asked them questions about what they did at night, et cetera, et cetera. So just, it was really just more like a survey.
Like
and there was definitely a correlation between later classes and poorer grades and being more sleepy, having excessive daytime sleepiness, and that correlated with drinking more alcohol in the evening. But you can imagine that students who wanted to stay up late drinking arranged their schedule so that they had later classes. Right? It's possible that the cause and effect is going the other way, or that students who were serious about their college work either preferred morning classes or were not afraid to take morning classes. So it could be that, you know, the not the effect of sleeping late, but kids who arranged their schedule so they can't sleep late were not as serious about their schoolwork. Yeah.
So I think I'm formally below chance now for this year, guys.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
Well, I am better off zero out of one.
Choosing at random. Yeah.
Still, I went with the strength. Well, the strength went with
me. Your reasoning was solid. Yeah. Your reasoning was solid. I just, you know, I was tricky this week.
Jay, not just formally below chance. I think you're irrevocably below chance.
Irrevocably? Wow. Sounds like a bet.
Oh. Oh, another bet. Well, that was fun, the bet that came out for Tam Oz.
It did, actually.
That's right. The one that I won? Oh, yeah, that was
Yeah, the one that Bob won.
I mean, Bob, we could do another one and do it at Tam Vegas if you want.
Or reveal it on the 24-hour show.
Oh, boy, you're a glutton.
Since Rebecca kicked her ass the last 2 weeks, Bob, why don't you and Rebecca do it?
There you go.
That could be interesting.
Yeah.
Contest.
Yeah,
all right.
Skepticism. All right.
3, 2, 1. It's on. There it is.
Ding, ding, ding.
Wow. Bob.
So what are we going to do?
Bob, I can't believe you said that to Rebecca. Holy shit, Rebecca.
It would be nice to have something to validate the fact that I'm usually on top of the science or fiction rankings.
Oh,
because
Rebecca likes it on top.
I was going to say, that wasn't the first thing that popped into my mind when you said you liked it.
And Rebecca, you're going to let Bob get away with that
Rebecca,
shit?
You won it in 2010. You were the queen. You beat everybody in 2010. Not in 2009, but in 2010.
Oh, listen to them
go.
So we'll see who does the best or the better between the two of you over the next four weeks.
Or better, yeah.
All right. A gentleman's wager.
Yeah, well, Evan and I do the idiot dance. Thank you.
And the rest of us will decide on what the loser has to do for the winner.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Yes. Okay. Every person committee on that.
Yeah, that's fine.
We'll try not to make it so lame
this
time.
Yeah, something better this time.
Jay, do you have a quote this week?
This quote was sent in by Nemo. It's all he or she said.
Nemo.
Nemo.
And this was a quote from a man named John Stuart Mill. And John Stuart Mill was...
He's funny. I watch him every night.
No, you don't. He died in 1873, Evan.
Oh, he's in the Monty Python philosopher's song. Mm-hmm.
He was a philosopher. He was a British philosopher, economist, and a civil servant.
To quote on John Stuart Mill, of his own free will, on half a pint of shandy was particularly ill.
Wow. You are an incredibly intelligent man, Michael. You are. Okay, so here's the quote. He who only knows his side of the case knows little. His reasons may have been good, and no one may have been able to refute them, but if he is equally unable to refute the reasons on the opposite side, then he has no ground for preferring either option. John Stuart Mill!
Michael, you have to appreciate that, being a lawyer.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Yes, exactly right. You can't just mount your own case and hope the other side doesn't turn up.
Right, right. So, Michael, was it everything you thought it was going to be?
Everything and more.
Oh, good.
Good answer.
Because, you know, we're auctioning off another slot at Tam.
Well, let me talk it up. There's a lot more bonus stuff that you don't hear on the program, and it's even more fun.
Oh, yeah.
It's not at all just us cursing at each other.
Michael, you get to see how the sausage is made.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, thanks for joining us, Michael, and thanks for joining me, everyone.
Yeah, thanks, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
It was
good to have you, Michael.
Except for science fiction, it was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I had fun.
Yeah.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe.
The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org.
You can also check out our other podcasts, the SGU 5x5, as well as find links to our blogs and the SGU forums. For questions, suggestions and other feedback, please use the Contact Us form on the website or send an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. If you enjoyed this episode, then please help us spread the word by leaving us a review on iTunes, Zune, or your portal of choice.